I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. So how many people can write a book and get glowing blurbs from Cory Booker and Rick Santorum, Bernie Sanders and Mike Huckabee? Well, apparently Van Jones can. He even got a shout out from Jeffrey Lord on the back of his new book, Jones' former sparring partner on CNN. The book is titled Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. He talked to liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, Trump supporters and Trump critics, and found out that there are common issues they all care about: criminal justice, jobs, urban and rural poverty, the opioid epidemic, even the environment. He writes in his book, in a sane society, common pain should lead to common purpose. Van Jones is a progressive activist, founder of the Dream Corps, and he is a CNN political commentator, and he joins us on Radio Times. Van Jones, nice to have you with us on the air.
I'm glad to be here.
Let me go back a year. You predicted that Donald Trump would become president of the United States. What did other people either dismiss or ignore or not understand that you seem to understand?
Well, I am. First of all, I mean, I grew up in rural West Tennessee. My parents were public school teachers. My dad had been a cop in the military. Church going, not every week, but every other week. We weren't strangers there. But
well, you're a church goer.
Yeah, church goer.
That qualifies.
Yeah, that qualifies. And my family still lives in Tennessee. And so I was going back and forth from, you know, the coasts where all my friends were, oh, Trump can't possibly win. Oh, my God. But I was hearing different things and I was understanding different things. And I realized that his use of Twitter, which people, oh, these are gaffes. So, you know, saying outrageous stuff on Twitter or reality television gets you more followers and bigger ratings. He's not breaking the rules of media. He's following the new rules of the new media system. I thought a lot of the stuff that people were saying about, oh, you know, he's offending people of color, therefore he can't win. You know, I just looked at the math. I said, that doesn't actually make sense. I mean, Democrats got to get 93% of the black vote to even be competitive. You know, so I just felt that there was we kind of gotten a little bit too smug and that we weren't realizing that this was a rebellion afoot.
You called this a white lash.
I said it was a white lash in part, which actually then offended a bunch of Trump voters who thought I was saying that every single Trump voter who voted for the guy was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, which is not what I was saying at all. I was trying to point out that in this dynamic, you had 60 million people, everybody voted for a variety of reasons, but there was this nasty strain of white nationalism, white resentment that had been whipped up in a much more overt way than we had seen for generations in the country. And I wanted to make sure that in all the kind of antiseptic commentary that night, we did not forget that this was a factor. And I said white lash. Now that term is in the dictionary.
Is it really?
Yeah, which is a crazy thing. And I realized that delighted a lot of people, but also offended a lot of people. And I realized that, we're talking past each other. And that's why I decided I wanted to write a book that might help people understand each other a little bit better and maybe identify some common ground. We're going to have to fight on a bunch of stuff. And we're not going to back down on transgender people being mistreated and other people being mistreated. Muslims, LGBT, the Dreamers. And we're going to have to fight very hard on the stuff that is not negotiable. But we also, you can't just fight and still have a country. We're also going to have to find some places where we can get something done in America. And the book is designed to try to help sort that out.
You accuse liberals / Democrats of being snobs, looking down on people who voted for Trump. You said, what is it, 60 million people? Mm-hmm. You say they're not all racists.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of the problem is that, you know, all too often, not everybody, not every liberal, not every progressive. Now we're talking in big, big generalizations. But just for the heck of it, if we can just be a little bit vulgar vulgar, not profane, but okay. But just vulgar in our assessment of things and not too refined. There tends to be this thing among liberals where we kind of get together and we say, "Oh well, those stupid Republican red state voters, those dumb white guys, these ignorant, unwashed, uneducated backwaters that keep." Now, that's the way that colonizers talk about third world countries. That's the way that colonizers talk about people. This idea that you have these ignorant, unwashed people that need to be converted to your religion, to maybe our, here we are, our NPR religion, and force fed a little bit of kale, and then they'll, you can raise them up to our level, and then they'll be worthy people. That kind of attitude shows up, and it leads to situations where a Hillary Clinton can say half of Trump's voters are deplorable. 30 million Americans are deplorable? 30 million? You shouldn't be president if you think that we have 30 million irredeemable, deplorable people in the country. I don't care what party you're in. But how did that happen? It happened because there's a little bit of an elitism that has crept into our party that we've got to challenge.
Well, I want to talk about what Trump has said about people, and we should get to that. But let me play a clip, and this is from your CNN show, The Messy Truth. You were talking, you go to a house, and there are, I think, a father and two or three sons talking about who they voted for. Let's give it a listen.
What did you like about Obama, and then what did you like about Trump?
I think Obama represents a lot of love, and I think that he's a good man, and he did all he could, and we supported him for two elections.
Yeah.
And then when those changes really didn't come about, and Obamacare actually affected me personally with my own mother, I think we needed a change once again.
Mm-hmm.
Trump seemed to come through here, and he's speaking change again, so I think we still voted for change.
Van Jones. I mean, these are the people you're saying that Democrats don't understand or don't respect.
If we respect them, we do a good job of hiding it. We don't communicate it. We'll say, well, my goodness, our policies are so much better for those people. If they would just go to our website, they would see how much better we are. Well, hold on a second. That's not a good answer. People need to feel seen and respected and heard. And you know, listen, there are just some hardcore bigots in America. I mean, Nazis in America. And all of them voted for Donald Trump. But that doesn't mean that everybody who voted for Donald Trump is a Nazi. You know, just because he got the 100% of the Nazi vote doesn't mean 100% of his voters are Nazis, not by a long shot. Mm. And you have people who did vote for Obama twice and then jumped the fence. And those are the people that I want liberals to understand. The reason I wrote this book is because I think that We are now guilty sometimes of painting with too broad a brush, which is what we hate for other people to do. But we're now, when we say Trump voter, we aren't thinking about that that family who liked us enough to give us a chance a few times, but this time just felt so misunderstood that they fired off some distress signals. And I want people to understand those folks better.
Well, I certainly agree with you about Hillary calling millions of people deplorables. Obviously, a wrong thing to say politically and every other way as well.
Morally.
Morally and all of that. But it does raise the question about how Donald Trump was able to say all those things, whether it was about a Gold Star family or about John McCain. I mean, I could go on and on and on, the Access Hollywood tape. And I've run this experiment in my head. If Barack Obama said any of those things, it would be a disqualifier. And we've talked about this on Radio Times, and I've had people call in and say, well, you know, my brother talks that way, and, you know, maybe he was making a joke. How do you understand the pass, I guess, that our president got on some of his comments?
Well, I mean, if you are a rich white guy, you get away with stuff in America. That's just, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. That's why, you know, people would like to be, you know, rich and all that kind of stuff. You get away with stuff. And no woman could have gotten away with 0.01% of the stuff. It's just, you know, the system is unfair in that regard. However, it's also the case, once you get under that, that he was picking some scabs and picking some sores that we may not realize we helped to create. Now, this is very hard.
We meaning
liberals, progressives. And this is very hard to talk about. It's very triggering for people. That's why I do it at book length, to try to walk people through it. But there is a way sometimes that those of us who have been and are still being oppressed and discriminated against and victimized and traumatized, as we start trying to push back and speak back and get some kind of justice, it can be done in a way that if we aren't careful, and it's not fair, you have to be this careful, but if you're not careful, it can sometimes sound like if you're a white guy, you're the enemy. If you're a straight white male, you are by definition, you got horns on your head in our conversation. And so when those folks overhear us talking, they could come to the conclusion, these folks just don't like me, they're against me, they don't understand me, they want me to own my privilege, they don't understand I also have pain. And then a Donald Trump can walk in the back door and say, guys, I understand you, and have an appeal that is shocking to people that I think would be less available to him if we were a little bit better, and we have to get better, at signaling that we care about those folks too.
You write, let's be honest, as factories closed down and the morgues filled up from overdoses and suicides, I do not recall many civil rights groups, women's rights groups, or environmental organizations sending help to small town America. Do you think that's one of those scabs?
Yeah, look, I went to West Virginia before and after the election. I went to Indiana. I went to, red parts of Michigan. I looked around, man, I had no idea the level of just economic and cultural and spiritual destruction that has just befallen huge parts of this country. I mean, you're talking about towns where no factories, there are no stores. I mean, you've got a Blockbuster Video that's been closed down for 7 years and the chains have rusted to the gate. And grass is growing up through the parking lot in what used to be a thriving neighborhood. And you've got people dropping dead like flies.
From the opioid
epidemic. Suicides are off the chart. And nobody is coming to help. And I thought to myself, you know what? If I lived here, I might vote for somebody like a Donald Trump just to send a signal. Don't forget about us out here. We're dying out here. Now, is it right that you then take that pain and that concern and you marble it in with a bunch of toxic, racist crap and xenophobia? No, that's wrong. You have to fight that. But there is a there that when they say, the forgotten middle American voter, you get to middle America? Yeah, we forgot about you. You're right about that.
That's Van Jones, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a CNN political commentator, and he's got a new book. It's called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this very short break. Excuse me. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Van Jones about his new book, and it's called Beyond the Messy Truth. Let me read a couple of comments. This from an email from Paul says, I believe the Democrats will fail in 2020 due to their elitism and their inability to understand what is the reality of America in 2017. You're nodding your head, Van Jones. A comment from Michael says, change without knowing what? If you vote with the KKK, what does that say about you? Which the idea is that if you vote for Donald Trump, you are Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I want to say to people, because a lot of me and my progressive friends are mad at me. They're like, Van, this is not a time to be talking about building bridges and reaching out. This is a time where we got to fight these guys. We got to fight them at the Churchill time, And you're right on a bunch of issues, 100%. And I've been at front lines on criminal justice and immigrant rights and transgender stuff for 20 years. But the question you got to ask yourself, do you want him to win again? Do you want Donald Trump? Do you want to be sitting there in November 2020 with your head in your hands again? If not, what are you willing to rethink and do differently to ensure this never happens again? That's what this book is for. And so, if you start with that, you get suddenly very curious. So you say, well, this guy, you know, he's voting with the Klan, et cetera, so therefore he's a Klan. Here's the deal. This line that came very popular, if you vote for a bigot, you are a bigot. You vote for a sexist, you are a sexist. That's one of the most destructive lines of reasoning to prevent our victory in 2020, because you're basically handing Trump 60 million people off the top. I say no. People voted for Hillary Clinton who didn't agree with her on very much. People held their nose on Hillary Clinton, and a lot of people held their nose on Donald Trump. You know, for them, maybe it was about abortion, or it was about, frankly, Benghazi, or any number of things. You know, these Facebook ads really got in people's heads.
Yes, they did.
That we now are learning about. So you can't both say that Russia got in here and used Facebook ads to trick people and then say everybody who voted for him is a Klan member. Those two things don't go together. So you got to take a look at this thing, and you got to say, hold on a second. I want to make sure that I really understand his coalition so I can take it apart.
Well, let me pick up. This is a bit of history here, but you do talk about Bill Clinton when he was president. We got NAFTA. We got the war on drugs, which, of course, led to mass incarceration. There was the deregulation of Wall Street that happened late in his term. And then you go into the Bush administration and you've got the Iraq war. And you also say the fact that we cannot figure out how to have a sensible immigration reform system, that those things together created some of this environment that we're talking about today.
Look, I call those the four horsemen of the Trumpocalypse.
trademark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But listen, both political parties signed off on this insanity where you had Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich holding hands and saying, hey, we're going to have these bad trade deals. We're going to deregulate the banks. We're going to build prisons everywhere. And then right away, Hillary's, and the Bush, we're going to get into these wars overseas. It'll all work out. And we're not going to do anything on immigration. So liberals can't be happy because we're not welcoming the newcomers, and the conservatives can't be happy because we aren't throwing people out left and right. And the whole thing is a mess. And so by the time you get to 2016, a rebellion in both parties is inevitable because the elites in both parties had so let us down. So then you put up the Clinton brand and the Bush brand, and you're going to get, a horrific backlash or exciting backlash, but you're going to get a serious backlash. And so you had 47% of people vote for Bernie Sanders, the Bernie Sanders rebellion inside the Democratic Party, and you saw the Trump rebellion. My point is simply this. You have to take responsibility if you are a big Democrat for the fact that our party let a lot of people down. Mass incarceration. We were a pro-incarceration, pro-free trade, pro-Wall Street, and briefly pro-war party for 20 years. Plus, you now expect the people who've suffered from that, the young people, the African-Americans, the Appalachians, the Rust Belt work, you expect everybody to just go along with what your pollsters say and follow? No, you're going to have to figure out a way to really relate to the pain of the people. And from my point of view, there's common pain across the country. We just don't have common purpose yet.
You're an equal opportunity critic in this book. You talk about the Republicans as well. And you make an interesting point about a lot of Muslim families in this country are in many ways conservative about their values, about their faith, about family, about work. You compare, I don't know if it's a real family or two fictional families, saying, in many ways, these people would be conservative and probably vote Republican.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I mean, the Republican Party is a disaster right now. It's a horrific set of missed opportunities and bad intentions all mixed up together right now, and calling itself a conservative movement. There's nothing conservative about this Republican Party. It is an anti-liberal party. That's what it's become. It's an anti-Obama, anti-liberal party. And so as long as they can attack liberal institutions, liberal ideas, and liberal constituents, they don't care about their actual governing philosophy very much. As you can see, they let Trump get away with stuff that, again, I mean, they wouldn't let their children get away with because they're primarily anti-liberal. And so the book is tough love to both parties.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need better conservatives and better liberals. If you're a Republican, then great, be a Republican. And what that would mean would be defend the country from overseas threats like Russia, What that would mean would be defend the Constitution from threats to the First Amendment, which we're seeing from the White House. Be a real conservative. But, you know, I think that, you know, there are tremendous missed opportunities. And I want to say something about the Muslim community, which is just not said enough. Muslim Americans are the most extraordinary Americans we've got. American Muslims, lowest crime rate, lowest divorce rate, one of the highest educational attainment for women. Every Muslim you know has a job, a college degree, and or a business. Why are we mad at them? These are the best folks we've got. And if you want to go head to head with ISIS, just give these people the microphone. You got not only are American Muslims some of the best Americans, they're some of the best Muslims. Why are we attacking these people? So I say to the Republicans, these are people from a faith and family and entrepreneurship point of view you should be reaching out to and lifting up. Instead, you put them down. Why? Because you're not conservative. You're anti-liberal. And anti-liberal is a way for you to win elections. It's not a way to unite the country. It's not a way to govern. And I want Republicans to be better Republicans. And I want Democrats to be better Democrats.
Let me talk about pundits on cable TV, of which you are one.
Yes, I am.
You write in your book, essentially, they're part of the problem. The nightly death match between talking heads is in danger of reducing our national discourse to a farce.
Yes.
Saying that to yourself?
I do. I say it every night. And part of the reason why, you know, folks on the left and the right get mad at me is because I don't just go down the normal, you know, pathway of just smashing on my opponents. But sometimes, you know, you have to fight.
Well, in fact, I have a clip. I think this is 2 o'clock in the morning after the election of Donald Trump, and you and Corey Lewandowski are getting a little testy with each other.
You won.
So where is the conciliatory note to say, I want my people to support one president? On, where's that message?
It's got to start with you, man.
No, it has to start with the president who ran. It has to start with Hillary Clinton, who ran. Look, I didn't run for president. John Podesta didn't run for president.
See, this is the fear. Here it is. You see it. You won.
Say it again. I didn't hear you.
You won.
That's right. And Hillary Clinton should say that to the American people and say, support Donald Trump because he's one president.
This is it. Let me finish. I'm not done. Look, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. She'll talk in the morning.
Will she?
Let him finish.
Corey, you're being a horrible person right now. Let me finish.
If this was Donald Trump, the hypocrisy would be so outrageous right now.
I want every parent at home.
At 2 o'clock in the morning.
I want every parent at home who's up right now, who's trying to figure out how are we going to get through this, right? Where's the grace going to come from? Where's the understanding? Where's the empathy going to come from? It's going to have to come from ordinary people. Tomorrow at work, when we go and look at people who we don't agree with, this can't be the interaction.
An interesting interaction and exchange. I mean, you're basically saying, don't listen to us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that night I was quite aware that my children were watching. You know, they were in California. They were up at 11 o'clock at night. And there were kids and people watching all around the world trying to figure out what kind of world are we in. And I was trying to insist. I mean, listen, I am very close friends with a lot of Republicans, you know, Newt Gingrich, you know, even Jeffrey Lord. Corey is really a bad person.
Is a bad person.
I have to say that because he refused, even in victory, to show the kind of grace and the kinds of character that you expect from even a fourth grader on a soccer pitch. And that wasn't just, you know, that night. He went on being that way. So listen, I'm not somebody who's just a Pollyanna person. If you're going to be a terrible, horrible person as he was being and he continues to be, I'm going to call you on it. But I'm going to call both sides because we also want to make sure that, you know, people who are progressive are living up to our values. And when you hear progressives say, you know, saying the kinds of things that we say about people who we disagree with, that doesn't work either.
Let me get, it looks like Tim from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Ben. And morning.
Hi there.
Hi. I have a question for Van regarding the whitewashing, as he termed it. I appreciate your earnest attempt at objectivity in your book. But do you think that affirmative action policies on the basis of race versus wealth or some other factor contributed to the so-called whitewashing?
That's an interesting question. What do you think?
Look, I think that there are some people who feel resentful about diversity efforts. We used to call them, you know, affirmative action, diversity efforts. And I think that I understand those resentments. However, I think that those resentments have been stoked way beyond what's reasonable. If you look at the actual rates of racial integration and, frankly, gender integration into huge parts of the economy, we're actually losing ground in a lot of places. And so, I think that sometimes people will point to those programs where they don't even exist. They just see an African-American in a position of power and they assume that that person shouldn't be there. So listen, is that a can that be a stone in the shoe? Absolutely. What I would say is that we sometimes underestimate the heroism of our own cause as Americans. We are trying to do something that nobody has done in 10,000 years of human history. 300 million people trying to have a democracy with every color, every faith, every kind of human ever born in one country. The policy agenda is sometimes going to be difficult. The conversation is going to be difficult. And it's okay for us to fight where we disagree. But in this book, I try to point out places where without having to stop being a Republican and without having to stop being a Democrat, we could actually get some stuff done too. We're supposed to fight where we disagree, but we can't only fight and still have a country.
And that is Van Jones, our guest on Radio Times today. His new book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. And you can join our conversation by calling us, as Tim did, at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me pick up. You mentioned Newt Gingrich several times during our discussion here. Let me quote something you say about him. In Newt's narrative, it sometimes seems that the American Republic was born nearly perfect, but then fell from grace. But in my mind, our nation was born imperfect and has been climbing ever since, which is a very interesting and concise way of talking, I think, about this argument we have about, are we the greatest country that ever existed, ever? Yeah. But also, I am interested in your relationship. Is that too strong a word?
Friendship.
Yeah. Friendship with Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Help us understand that.
Sure. Well, Newt and I just don't agree on very much, but that doesn't.
But I think for a lot of people, be friends with someone with whom you disagree.
You know,
some pretty essential points.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The grown people are now flunking kindergarten. Okay, we actually expect our children to do better on this than we are doing it ourselves. Yes, you and Timmy don't like the same things. You disagree about this, but we still want you to be friends. We still want you to play well together. You can learn from that kid. But screw Jimmy's dad because he voted for Trump. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't make any sense. Newt and I had a TV show together called Crossfire. We didn't agree on very much, but it turned out that we did agree on two things. He has an addiction in his family, and I have addiction in my family. So we agreed on that we should change a lot of policies to help stop this epidemic of deaths from opioids. Also, Newt, as a conservative, said he didn't understand why we weren't doing more about criminal justice. He said, from his point of view, the prison system is just a big failed government bureaucracy wasting money, even though he passed some of the bills. And he says he passed those bills. But he says, in hindsight now, you create a big government bureaucracy. It wastes a ton of money. The libertarians in his party are afraid about gobbling up all these rights and all these liberties. And as a conservative Christian, and we both share the same faith, where's the redemption? Where's the second chance?
Forgiveness, you mean?
Yeah, forgiveness. And I said, well, you know, where you been all my life? I didn't know you felt this way. He goes, I've been talking about this for years. Liberals never listen. I said, let's work together. And so we actually got legislation introduced into Congress together. We've worked together closely. My point is simply this. Newt said, your 90% enemy can still be your 10% friend where you agree. And that's just called being an adult. Where Newt and I disagree, we fight very, very hard. But where we do agree, we work together just as hard. And that's what a democracy is supposed to allow you to do. This is not a tribal society where you have to just you know, be for your own cause, even when it's wrong, and against everybody who's not like you. That's what we're trying to get away from. And now both liberals and conservatives are increasingly tribal in our politics. That won't work.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but it seems that criminal justice is an area where people of different political persuasions can and have yes. come together. And it's interesting, even back in the 90s, the Congressional Black Caucus was for the really tough on crime laws that were put into place.
Yeah, against the screaming outrage of grassroots activists like myself who said this is going to be a huge disaster. Again, we had bipartisanship at the top in the 90s. It was bipartisanship of, by, and for the elites, including the elites in the black community, and it was a disaster. And now we need bipartisanship from below, of, by, and for ordinary people who the pain is common. Red counties, blue cities, you got poverty, you got addiction, you've got no real pathway to jobs. The pain is common, red to blue. We need a bipartisanship from below, a positive populism, not a demonizing a populism that says, you know, every Muslim is a terrorist and every Mexican's a rapist and every Wall Street banker is, you know, is a horrible person. We need a positive populism that says we can fix this stuff, but we've got to turn to each other and not on each other to get it done across these lines. And you can stay a Republican, just vote for better Republicans. I'll stay a Democrat and I'm going to vote for better Democrats. Maybe we get something done.
And that's Van Jones. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Van Jones is our guest. He's a CNN political commentator, founder of The Dream Corps. He's a progressive activist, unabashed progressive activist. And he's also the author of a new book we've been talking about, Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Let me play a clip. And this was after the president gave his State of the Union address.
Yes.
And it was really the moment where he addressed Karen Owens, the wife of slain U.S. Navy SEAL William Ryan Owens, essentially acknowledging his sacrifice and obviously her sacrifice as well. And this is what you said.
He became president of the United States in that moment, period. There are a lot of people who have a lot of reason to be frustrated with him, to be fearful of him, to be mad at him. But that was one of the most extraordinary moments you have ever seen in American politics, period. And he did something extraordinary. And for people who have been hoping that he would become unifying, hoping that he might find some way to become presidential, they should be happy with that moment. For people who have been hoping that maybe he would remain a divisive cartoon, which he often finds a way to do, they should begin to become a little bit worried tonight. Because that thing you just saw him do, if he finds a way to do that over and over again, he's going to be there for 8 years. Now, there is a lot that he said in that speech that was counterfactual, that was not right, that I oppose and will oppose. But he did something tonight that you cannot take away from him. He became president of the United States.
A lot of people got angry at you, Van Jones, for saying that. But did that moment last?
Well, it didn't last, but I want to stick with the moment. I'm very proud. Look, there are very few things in that I've done in my public life that I'm more proud of than that moment. Very few. Because I think that, you know, a lot of progressives never heard of me before election night, and they heard, oh, he's the guy that said white lash. So he's just going to whip on Donald Trump. He's going to be my teddy bear. He's only going to tell me stuff I want to hear. He's going to be my mouthpiece. And in that moment, I want you to remember what had happened. From the time Donald Trump came down that escalator to attack Mexicans and launch his campaign, there had not been one unifying moment. We had shootings. We had had, you know, terrorist attacks. We had had disasters. Not one moment of national unity, not the election, not the inauguration, not one. And people had, you know, decided that's how it was going to be. And then he goes into the chamber, and I've been there, I've seen it, I've covered it. Every other president who's come into that chamber, both sides rush over, they try and shake his hand. Not one Democrat shook his hand because he's that kind of a polarizing, nasty figure. Never seen it before. He gets up there, gives a speech, terrible speech, and he gets to at one moment, and for the first time since he came down the escalator, the entire country came together to acknowledge something. And you had a moment. I said, if he does that, if he can find a way to do that, we're in trouble. Now, within days, he threw it.
I was going to say.
But who cares? When you're doing live TV or live radio, you've got to call the pitch as it was thrown in that moment. Yeah, the cynical, easy thing to say is, well, yes, he had a good moment, but he's a terrible person. He's always going to be a terrible person. And that would have been the safe, easy thing to do. But you have to be able to look past your partisan preferences and point out when something good happens, 99 bad things. If one good thing happens, you got to be willing to call it. And I was willing to call it.
Interesting. And I was actually looking at an interview that you did. This was after Charlottesville. I think it was probably on CNN. I guess it was with Anderson Cooper. You were crying, and this was as a result of the neo-Nazis walking through Charlottesville and the president's reaction.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have a white terrorist movement in the country using ISIS tactics to mow down Americans with cars, assassinating Americans in broad daylight, and the president comes out and says, you know, some glib nonsense. And you had people saying horrific anti-Jewish slurs. My godmother is Jewish. And I was sitting there thinking about her and her last years of life having to cut on TV and hear this type of crap in the streets of America, and the president doesn't come out and denounce it. And I got very upset. Listen, I think we should get upset. Nazis marching in America and the president can't figure out a way to denounce them. So, but I think that what I want to say about that is this is a very tough business. I am on television a lot, and it's live. And what you feel in that moment, usually people don't say. They want to say, what are my talking points? What are the Democrats supposed to say today? I'm just going to say that. And I think that's a part of what's wrong. And so if I see a moment of hope, I'm going to call it. If I see a moment of despair, I'm going to call it. But I tried to put all that in the book so that people can have a little bit more access to the thinking that goes into some of the observations and maybe reflect anew on their own observations.
Let me get Betty from Maple Glen to join our conversation. And Betty, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for this profound and wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you.
I am very concerned about the future of the Democratic Party and progressives, because what I'm not seeing or reading or hearing are the elected officials of the party actually going to these blighted communities where Mr. Jones went, observing their bereft, they have nothing, and wondering why people voted for Trump. What is the Democratic Party, Progressive Party, what do they have concretely to offer people who voted for Trump?
Well, Betty,
yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I can see that Van Jones wants to answer your question. I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Well, hey, listen, I'm with you, sister. Anti-Trumpism is not enough. If you didn't learn anything, if we didn't learn anything in 2016, we still have the same response. Every time he does something stupid and ignorant and ridiculous, we go, oh my God, that's stupid, ignorant, and ridiculous. How can anybody? Hey guys, you know, you think Trump is crazy? The definition of crazy is to do the same thing over and over expecting a different result, which means the progressives are just as crazy as Trump because we keep responding exactly the same way. If you don't want him to win again, we've got to do something different. So the book is an attempt to give people a way to think about it differently, to feel about it differently, and to act differently. We have literally a third of the book are resources, things that you can read, documentaries, podcasts from both sides so we can get more understanding, plus campaigns you can work on, groups you can join, causes like opioids, criminal justice, jobs that you can get involved with that we're working on at the Dream Corps where I work every day. We have lovearmy.org. You can sign up there. You can be a part of a book club. We're doing everything that we can to give people something to do besides just freak out every day over the news. Listen, it's been almost a year, guys. We can't just keep freaking out and freaking out and freaking out and hoping that by doing that, the next 20% of people that we need are going to come over. We're going to have to be different ourselves and go get them.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me read a bunch of comments that have come in. A tweet from Roy says, can we discuss the similarities between the socioeconomic situations of poor whites and blacks and unite people lacking opportunity? A tweet from Matthew. Please ask Van which is better for the Democrats, convincing Trump voters to vote Democratic or turning out existing Democratic-friendly voters, young people, and minorities. An email from Rosalind. It is impossible to point to a single Republican policy in the last 40 years that has helped these people. These people meaning, I'm assuming Rosalind means these people, the
red
poor
state.
In the red states who are, you know, in these hollowed out towns, which I think is an interesting point that she raises.
Yeah, look, I do think it's time for us to talk about the common ground between low-income African-Americans, whites, Latinos, Native Americans, not with the goal of saying that we should all be Democrats now, we should all be Republicans now, but saying that we should put those issues on the map for both parties and force both parties. Where are the Jack Kemps in the Republican Party? He used to talk about poverty. He used to come to black communities. You got Republicans now. They talk about Chicago, Chicago, Chicago. I haven't seen a single one of them go to one of those funerals and hold the hands of one of those mothers or grandmothers and look at those teddy bears and ask the question why of the people who are there. They demagogue the issue and as opposed to actually trying to help. That's morally wrong and depraved. And they've got – listen – if you care about this pain, let's work together on it. And I would say the same thing. You've got Republicans that have done very little for their poor base. You got poor white folks in red counties voting for Republicans for generations. They got nothing out of it. But honestly, you could say the same thing about some urban communities that have been voting for Democrats and haven't gotten much out of it. So that's got to be something that changes. Then people say, should we try to get the Trump voters, some of the former Obama, now Trump voters to come back home, or should we turn out our own base? The answer is yes. We should do both because that was the Obama coalition in 2008. All I'm saying, this book is basically just a way to say, can the Republican Party be better? Can Democrats be better? And also, can Democrats at least remember that there was a spirit in 2008 that was so infectious and so inspiring that people were willing to give Democrats a chance. That matters as well. And then as far as you know, people being let down, yeah, people have been let down by both parties.
Let me ask you about church. And
yes,
you say the black church is where you feel most comfortable, most accepted. And you seem to be saying that the Democrats are maybe too a-religious or there are too many atheists or agnostics in the Democratic Party. Flesh that out for us. And then I wanted to also, there's a very moving and inspiring part of this story, which, of course, we all felt it when it happened, which was the congregation at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, coming together and forgiving the man who murdered all those people.
Well, I don't think that we have too many atheists or agnostics. If that's you, where you're coming from, that's great. But it's how you are treating progressives who are people of faith. Don't forget, the African-American community is the most religious community in the country. The black church, everybody says like the black church, that's a real thing because under segregation and under slavery, the only institution we were allowed to have was the church. And even our colleges were extensions of the church. So the church is a central source of community and meaning and sustenance and resilience for the African-American community. Now, if you're female or if you're, you know, LGBTQ, you have a much more complicated relationship with the church, but it's still a dominant institution. So when you have white liberals often saying, oh, all those Christians, spitting it out like it's an insult, that sits poorly in the mouth since we actually, as African-Americans, vote 90% for Democrats. But I think that, you know, I got a chance to go to Charleston right after Dylann Roof.
Weren't you there for the funeral?
I was there for the funeral. I was there. You know, I was there within, I think, 24 hours of the shootings. I got a chance to walk through shortly after the blood had been cleaned up. And I don't think I've ever been angrier than I was that day. Just the idea that some Nazi would go and murder 9 African American, you know, churchgoers. And I don't think I was ever prouder than I was a few days later as the family members of those people who had been murdered came forward and said, we forgive him.
And it's extraordinary.
And even after he was found guilty and sentenced to death, the family members are fighting to keep him from being put to death. Now, that comes from a deep well of African-American pain and suffering over the centuries, where at our best we've arrived at a place where we understand that hatred will never defeat hatred, that only love can do that. And if those folks can forgive that horrific, horrific violation, I think we might be able to forgive a couple of Trump voters every now and again.
I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Michael to join our conversation. Shifting gears here. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And very quick question. You have tens of millions of people on both sides of the aisle that feel totally disenfranchised. You have millions of moderate Republicans who do not understand what has happened to their party that has been hijacked by a man that doesn't stand for the principles and values of a moderate Republican base. You have millions of Democrats that feel their party has been hijacked by a different type of Democratic profile that is right now in the political spectrum. Question, is the time right now for possibly third parties to be established by tens of millions of people who believe in cross-aisle cooperation and bridge building?
Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What do you think?
You know, third parties are structurally disadvantaged in our system because we don't have a parliamentary system. So it's a winner-take-all. Usually you wind up hurting the party closest to you politically when you do that. And yet I think that all bets are off at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if Oprah Winfrey runs for president or Dwayne Johnson runs for governor of California. Like, we're in a different state now. Do parties even matter? It's hard to know. So what I would say is that if you feel in your heart that you want to try something, I would say try it. Because even people moving in the direction of a third party might create healthier responses from the existing parties. Right now, the momentum in the parties is on the wings. I'm a left-wing Democrat, so most days I'm happy about that, seeing more people moving in my direction. But I'm trying to figure out a way to be realistic and say, where can the left wing and the right wing actually agree and work together and at least reduce some of the inflammation? Even when we're fighting over stuff, and there's some stuff we're going to have to fight over. Healthcare is one of them. But even when we're fighting over stuff, we still want to be able to switch from the battleground to some common ground every now and again, or you won't have a country. And by the way, if you democracies can fail. You don't want a civil war. You want to keep some sense of fellow feeling. And liberals sometimes have not been as good, certainly this past year, at finding that fellow feeling. And we should work on that.
We're ending on that note. Van Jones, thank you so much. Thanks
for
joining us today on Radio Times. The book is Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. I'm Marty Moscoen, and that's it for Radio Times today. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for the show, and is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. Thanks for joining us.